Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to the Children's Justice Project monthly training series. This training is offered to key stakeholders involved in Wyoming's juvenile court system and held every second Tuesday of the month from 12 to 1 p.m. To obtain the materials electronically for today's training, please visit the Children's Justice Project website at www.courts.state.wy.us/initiatives/CJP and then click the training tab in the middle of the screen. If there are any questions, participants are welcome to call in during the last 10 minutes of the training session. The call-in number is area code 917-889-8064. One may also post questions and comments using the online chat session on the Blog Talk Radio website. We hope you'll find today's training informative and would like to thank you for your attendance.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to a new season of Children's Justice Project Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Edie Troutwine, the Children's Justice Project Coordinator here at the Wyoming Supreme Court. The new season of Blog Talk Radio will run this month, December 2016, through May of 2017. We will be running episodes the second Thursday of the month, and this year we have released an advanced schedule of all episodes, and that schedule can be downloaded from our website. CJP has updated our website, and the new website can be found at www.courts.state.wy.us/CJP. Blog Talk episodes can be accessed by clicking the blue Blog Talk tab in the middle of the webpage. The handouts for today's presentation can be found on the site as well. Just click the download presentation link under today's episode to view the presentation during the presenter's talk. Today's presentation is entitled Working with Incarcerated Parents in Child Welfare, with a focus on improving outcomes for incarcerated parents and their children. The presentation is about an hour, and we will try to leave time at the end for questions. Please use the chat room function to type and ask questions. Our presenter today is Donna Platon, a Wyoming attorney with much experience in child welfare law. Her presentation today will provide information about the challenges incarcerated parents face in the child welfare system and promote a more in-depth understanding of issues impacting incarcerated parents and their children. The presentation will provide information about improving outcomes through careful consideration of the underlying factors, trends, and best practices that lead to successful reintegration into society for parents and healthier outcomes for families. On the Blog Talk link, we have provided some links to the Child Welfare Information Gateway. You can look through those guides and find publications about issues related to incarcerated parents and their children. We've specifically highlighted two publications. One, a guide for incarcerated parents who have children in the child welfare system, and also, when a parent is incarcerated, a primer for social workers. And with that, I'll turn it over to Donna.
Thank you, Edie, and thanks to the Children's Justice Project and all of the very important work that that commission does in regard to children in the child welfare system, including working with parents, and I hope to talk a little bit about working with parents as well today. When considering the impact of incarceration on our child welfare system, it's important to know that the United States has the highest incarceration rate and the most people incarcerated in the world. Over half of the 2.3 million individuals in United States jails and prisons are parents. And in 2006, an estimated 7,500,000 children had a parent who was incarcerated or under correctional supervision. The numbers speak for themselves, and a large amount of people are impacted. The nation's growing prison and jail population has raised serious questions about the collateral effects of incarceration on children, families, and communities. Whatever one's views about the appropriate role of incarceration in the criminal justice system, it is clear that imprisonment disrupts positive, nurturing relationships between many parents, particularly mothers, and their children. In addition, many families with children suffer economic strain and instability when a parent is imprisoned. Research suggests that intervening in the lives of incarcerated parents and their children to preserve and strengthen positive family connections can yield positive societal benefits in the form of reduced recidivism, less intergenerational criminal justice system involvement, and promotion of healthy child development. An arrest of a parent in itself is not grounds for an allegation of child abuse or neglect. Incarcerated parents or legal guardians have the right to child welfare services and reunification as ordered by the court. And it's important to remember, parents who are incarcerated are entitled to receive notice of all court hearings affecting their children as required by law. Though incarceration of a parent may be considered as an additional risk factor, and as in all cases, decisions regarding an incarcerated parent should follow laws and child welfare regulations, federal law requires child welfare agencies make reasonable efforts to preserve and reunify families in most cases. The law does leave it to local jurisdictions to determine what reasonable efforts are and to look at it on a case-by-case basis. Modifications are necessary in the visiting environments of most correctional institutions. Due to the drastic increase in prison population, we need to then update visiting environments to make them more developmentally appropriate. The United States is attempting to address mass incarceration, but still 2/3 of women in state prisons are there for nonviolent offenses. America now incarcerates 8 times as many women as it did in 1980, and only Thailand seems to imprison women at a higher rate. Like most public spaces, correctional visiting environments are not generally designed to meet the needs of children. Originally, we had low numbers of incarcerated people in the United States, and that meant that fewer children visited parents in jails and prisons. There was no perceived need for child-friendly visiting rooms until the prison populations began to rise in the late 1960s. Over the next decade, following dramatic increases in the number of visiting children, the need for more developmentally appropriate visiting areas began to emerge. Today, the need is at a critical point, and unfortunately, often coincides with cuts in funding and lack of trained employees or policies to implement best practices. How many children are impacted? In 2007, slightly more than 1.7 million children under age 18 had a parent in state or federal prison. That represents 2.3% of all children in the United States population. The number of children with a father in prison increased 77% between 1991 to 2007. And during that same time, the number of children with a mother in prison increased by 131%. So much of what we know about how many children are impacted comes from a series of reports by the Bureau of Justice Statistics on incarcerated parents and their children. Those in turn are based upon periodic national surveys of inmates in state and federal prisons. Most prisoners had at least one child under the age of 18. There's There are many risk factors that exist for children who have a parent who is incarcerated. Some of the things that are important to look at and screen when working with these families include: what was the pre-incarceration living arrangement? What was the quality of the parent-child relationship? What was the degree to which inmate parents participated in the daily care and financial support of their children prior to confinement? Also, screen for what is the child's current living arrangement, the amount of contact children have with their incarcerated parents, and the child's age, temperament, gender, and coping skills, among other factors. Because many studies fail to account for these background risk factors for children and include other methodological flaws, some claims about how parental incarceration affects children that appear in the research, advocacy, and policy literature might not be supported by empirical evidence. One such claim is that children of incarcerated parents are 6 times more likely than other children to be incarcerated as adults. While there are certainly common themes in the literature of negative impacts on children when a parent is incarcerated, there's no empirical data that currently supports that claim. And parental incarceration can affect many aspects of a child's life, including emotional and behavioral well-being, family stability, and financial circumstances. The consensus in the field is that these children are exposed to many risk factors and therefore have many effects. The risk factors for children of parental incarceration are subject to a host of variables that we need to look at on a case-by-case basis. We all need to screen for and be aware of factors that impact the developmental outcomes of children, including the level of family stress prior to incarceration, parental substance abuse, parental mental illness, and low levels of parental education prior to entering the correctional department being incarcerated. When attempting to intervene and support improved outcomes for children, it's also important to understand their adaptive responses to their situation. Services for children of prisoners need to address developmental resources, and we need to do this before or concurrently with improving their responses to their life circumstances. So looking at it, if you look at the risk factors prior to incarceration and you look at the different ways that you can intervene while the parent is incarcerated, you can see that the impact of the parental incarceration alone may actually have more limited effects on development of the children than we've originally thought. If you're following along on the slides, I am on slide number 8. When we're working with parents who are incarcerated, there are certain factors that differentiate them from people who are not incarcerated. There's overlap, but there's also very specific complexities that involve parents who are incarcerated. The women who are in state prison were more likely than men to report being a parent, though there's about half of the men and closer to 62% of women reported being a parent. The majority of men who are incarcerated were employed prior to incarceration. And the family structures are complicated. For example, the typical man had fathered children with 3 different women, and women typically co-parented with at least 2 different men. About 2/3 of the fathers had lived with at least one of their children before the incarceration, and almost as many also had at least 1 child who did not live with them. The typical man had fathered children with 3 different women. You can see how that can impact what the reasonable efforts for reunification or visitation or child support, some of the other issues that placement of children can be unique when working with this population. Reports of physical and emotional abuse within the relationships were also very common prior to incarceration, and the education levels of the parents was very low, particularly for men. And many of the members who were part of this survey, and I have a little link at the bottom there, reported learning difficulties. When considering which efforts will qualify as reasonable and information that is necessary to case planning, it is also important to keep in mind that pre-incarceration substance use was fairly high. Almost 3/4 of men and 1/4 of women reported using at least one illicit drug, including marijuana, in the 6 months prior to incarceration. Substance abuse and criminal justice involvement were prevalent in social networks. Both men and women had extended family members with a history of arrest and problems with alcohol and other drugs. And about 1 out of 3 men reported that all or most of their friends used illegal drugs. 19% reported that all or most of their friends had been incarcerated. 2/3 of women reported that the men's friends sometimes or often convinced them to do things they knew they should not be doing. This is important not only when case planning while the parents are incarcerated, but then also looking at how is it going to work upon reintegration back into society and back into the family. Also, in working with the women at the Wyoming Women's Center, I know that there can be a wait list to get into the intensive treatment unit for substance abuse treatment, and that can impact the timing that we're working under, the timing guidelines that we're working under when working with parents who had a history of substance abuse. There are some gender differences with parents. Today, mothers are the fastest growing segment of the United States prison population. The majority of women who are incarcerated are there for nonviolent crimes such as prostitution, fraud, or drug offenses. And many were caught up in criminal behavior as a result of being in an abusive relationship. Also, mothers in state prison were more likely than fathers to report homelessness, past physical or sexual abuse, and medical and mental health problems. Those all need to be integrated into appropriate case plans. When a parent is arrested or incarcerated, a child's life is interrupted and drastically altered. Studies show that about 1/4 of children remain with their fathers when the mother goes to prison, but nearly 9 out of 10 children remain with their mothers when the father is incarcerated. Many times, female inmates have lost custody and have had their children placed with somebody other than the other parent. So this may be a relative or foster care. Because women are disproportionately likely to be the primary caregivers, and 60% of American women in state prison have children under 18, it's really important to consider the collateral damage of imprisonment. There are other challenges based on the complexity of cases where parents are incarcerated. Just looking at the numbers themselves, if you're working with people who are incarcerated or you're working with somebody and then they're incarcerated, one of the links in the resources that Edie provided was a guide for incarcerated parents who have children in the child welfare system. And so I downloaded that and made copies of it so that the next time that we do intakes at the Wyoming Women's Prison, we can give these guides to some of the parents who are in there who sign up for legal assistance when we go to visit. I thought it was really helpful. And the purpose of the guide is to help parents involved in the criminal justice system work with the child welfare system to stay in touch with their children and stay involved in decisions about their children's well-being. The guide also includes important information on steps required by the child welfare system for reunification or having children return home to their family after foster care. Sometimes the inmates that we've interviewed are very confused about what the status of their parental rights are, where their children are, and why they can't have visitation. Many of them lose contact with their attorneys and the caseworkers in their child welfare cases. Some of the other issues include how do we work with children with disabilities, whether or not ICWA applies, what about child support issues, what about jurisdictional issues. A lot of times more than one state is involved or the children have been removed to a different state. And what do we do with immigrants who are incarcerated with regards to their children? So those are a number of issues, I think, that make these cases complex. Also, guardianships, foster care, grandparent caregiver visitation, and the mechanisms by which non-custodial parents can pursue visits with their children and enhance their options for access. So a lot of that will then depend on which court, whether or not somebody can access legal assistance. Usually, in my experience, it's been that they need somebody to help them out on a reduced fee or pro bono basis. Part of the complexity of these cases is that they can involve so many different issues. So let's just look for a moment at financial support for children. Consider it prior to incarceration, during, and after the parents are then released from imprisonment. About half of the parents in state prison provided the primary financial support for their minor children prior to imprisonment. Most fathers did make meaningful parental contributions before their incarceration. For most of their children, though, because you have separate families with children, separate mothers with children, the studies have found that not all of the children are getting financial support or the same level of financial support. Parental incarceration is obviously then associated with greater risk that a child will experience material hardship and family instability based on the financial support that is now missing. So child support is a big deal for most parents who are incarcerated. Many non-custodial parents, and by the time they're in prison, they're not the custodial parent at that time, though you still may have legal documentation that identifies them as such. Most parents whose children are placed in foster care are still expected by law to pay child support, even when they're in prison. A written request to modify child support is required, and there's no guarantee that the court will grant it. There's also no automatic suspension or reduction of child support that exists. So while we've worked, and I think that work can continue in this regard to screen parents of children who are incarcerated, child support can be one of those issues that we can look at and find out about earlier on. Trigger of enforcement and income withholding in the facility. But if you seek to modify your child support, you're incarcerated and you seek to modify your child support, it actually can trigger enforcement. So I've worked with people who would rather just leave it alone than have the little small amount of money that they might be generating while working in the prison garnished. So it's a real interesting catch-22 for many parents who are incarcerated. If they are going to modify, time is of the essence. Federal law and our state statutes also prohibit retroactive modification of child support arrears. Child support policies are also believed to affect inmate reintegration patterns, especially if they lead to large debts and wage attachments that drive paroled and released prisoners away from their families and legitimate employment. So if the arrears are so high, it can cause a lot of problems for people once they're trying to reintegrate. I am now on slide 17 if you happen to be following along. In order to modify child support, there can be different ways to do it, but usually when we're working with incarcerated parents, the obvious reason is a change in circumstances, and that can allow people to request a modification. For most courts, incarceration resulting in limited employment opportunities and really small wages can be seen as one such circumstance by the courts and by the judges. There are different views. Wyoming does have some case law. There's an old case from 1993, Glenn v. Glenn, that states when an incarcerated parent has income, that income can fairly be applied to child support obligations. There still are different views, though, on what the child support obligations of incarcerated parents should be. Courts and/or child support enforcement agencies may choose to treat parental incarceration as a form of voluntary underemployment, and the inmate's failure to request a modification or the failure to have a modification awarded may result in the accumulation of significant child support arrears during incarceration and the inmate's exposure to a host of punitive enforcement actions upon his or her release. Some agencies and courts have laws that specifically state that incarceration is one factor to be considered in assessing a motion for modification of child support. Wyoming statute has no specific mention of incarceration as a qualifying substantial material change in circumstance warranting a modification. And when you combine that with the discretionary nature of family law matters, the variability in agency and judicial behavior across Wyoming counties and courts, it may depend on how you present your case and who the judge is and what court they're in. Judges and county child support personnel do have latitude over whether to treat incarceration as voluntary unemployment and whether to grant or deny a request to modify a child support order downward. If you happen to be an attorney representing a parent in such a case, I think it's important to explain what some of the negative consequences can be of allowing huge amounts of arrearages to accrue when at the same time trying to work on reunification or understanding that many parents will reunify with their children upon release. Parents who owe child support may have up to 65% of their take-home pay garnished. They may also have their driver's license and/or their state-issued professional license suspended. They may be reported as delinquent on their credit reports. And that inability to pay the amount of arrears that can accrue can even land them with additional criminal charges and back in prison for failure to pay. Incarceration affects parents and children in many profound ways. Children may have to be placed on an emergency basis. Custody and visitation rights often change. Guardianship may be required. The child may be in foster care. and incarceration may lead to termination of parental rights. Parents who are incarcerated face a unique set of challenges because they must work within and across both the child welfare and the correction systems, and they may experience difficulties in meeting their case plan requirements, such as having regular visitations with their children or completing parent education within the time frame established by child welfare and by federal regulations, such as the Adoption and Safe Families Act. Obviously, children who are living in stable households with nurturing caregivers during their parents' incarceration are likely to fare better than children who experience family instability as a result of a parent being incarcerated. And children who are placed in foster care, that can mean several placements, loss of connection to school, community, friends, siblings, and extended family. The developmental outcomes of prisoners' children appear to be produced by the same factors that often lead to parental incarceration, including high levels of family stress, parental substance dependency, parental mental illness, parental education levels, looking at the fact that many incarcerated mothers were their family's sole caregiver. Many of their children do end up in foster care. It's hard. We don't have good data collection on how many children are in foster care who have a parent who is incarcerated. Some children are transported out of state where they have little or no opportunity to visit their mothers in prison, or either parent, actually. And some can be taken away from everything that's familiar to them, and you can see how that can have varying impacts on children depending on what resources are available to them in lieu of what caregiving they had by the parent who is now incarcerated. Foster care, at any given moment, 10% of the children of women prisoners and 2% of the children of incarcerated men are in foster care. Wyoming, as we all know, has a large need for qualified foster families, and we're all working under the auspices of ASFA anytime a child is in out-of-home placement, more particularly when placed with a non-relative. Grandparents, we see more and more grandparents with custody or guardianship of their grandchildren. Often this is fueled by both addiction and incarceration of the parents. 4.4 million children now live with a grandparent-headed household. Half of the children with incarcerated mothers and one-sixth of the children with incarcerated fathers are cared for by grandparents. So when that happens, they're losing not only their primary parent, but oftentimes when grandparents have to take on the role of parent, the kids are also losing their grandparent. Grandparents often have less financial resources available to them, often less so than foster parents do. Nearly two-thirds of children are being raised by single grandmothers living in poverty. Additional expenses associated with maintaining contact with the incarcerated parent can be really particularly hard on grandparents, including phone charges, travel, money for commissary, etc. Then on top, when we're dealing with case plans, we're dealing with ASFA, we're dealing with placement of children, developmental appropriate resources for children, we're looking at some issues with visitation. There, when a parent is incarcerated, there's a dramatic reduction in contact between the parent and the child. One half of incarcerated parents don't receive any visits from their children. And most of those who do receive visits are not visited regularly or frequently. Incarcerated mothers see their children even less frequently than incarcerated fathers, even though they often have closer relationships with their children prior to incarceration, with more than half of the children never visiting their mothers in prison. Best practices require that the child welfare community engage in sensitive planning and support of children. Best practices to ensure that children are cared for and informed, have access to services, and are able to have contact with their incarcerated parent if it's determined to be in their best interest, of course. Parent-child visitation can substantially decrease the negative impacts by preserving the child's relationship with the parent. Maintaining contact during incarceration has also been correlated with reduced recidivism rates by the parent, minimizing the re-traumatization of the child. I think, at least I know when I started practicing, I didn't think a prison was any place for a child. That would be a terrible place to have visitation. And I think that there are still attorneys and caseworkers and judges who still feel that same way. So important to understand that visitation is really important to kids and their development. And, you know, obviously it's got to be when it's in their best interest, not with a parent who's abusive. But most of the studies say the most effective form of visitation is actual contact visitation. So what I've learned over time is that most children know that their parent is incarcerated. And when they're unable to see them, they're unable to lay their eyes on that parent, their imaginations go wild. They're thinking, when you think about what it means to be in jail or to be in prison, and kids can think of dungeons, they can think of balls and chains, they can think of monsters, and it can be so helpful for the children to actually be able to see their parent with their own eyes, to know that they're okay, that they're in this different place, but that they're safe, they're alive, and they're okay. I'm now on slide 29. Visitation is important to help get children ready for when the parent reintegrates as well. So studies show that family ties along with stable employment help to reduce recidivism and improve the success of prisoners who move into parole. Family relationships and understanding of the reintegration process are key to the success of inmates upon their release. And some research indicates that visiting is important in maintaining this parent-child relationship and increases the likelihood that reunification will be successful after release, which should be our goal when putting together case plans in most of these cases anyway. Parent-child visitation is one of the most important elements, and I think it's one that's happening the least in our facilities. There are, of course, many barriers to visiting a parent who's incarcerated. Practitioners found that a lack of affordable transportation to the prison was a major barrier to parent-child correctional visitation. Some corrections policies may claim to be family-friendly, but then charge exorbitant amounts to call out from a facility, for example, have really restricted times for visitation. And so some of those can be theory versus reality. It's important, I think, to find out what are the policies. I know that even considering the fact that we have a nursery at the Wyoming Women's Center that's not and never has been put to use for lack of funding and available staff, I mean, the theory is good on that, but the reality is that it's not accessible to any of the mothers who are up there now, and men have the same type of issues, and they can even be compounded in their facilities. If you have the caregiver of the child unwilling to try to accommodate visitation, including if that caregiver is a foster parent, that can also pose a barrier to visitation with the incarcerated parent. The caregiver, you may have caregivers feel like I felt when I first started out, that further contact with the imprisoned parent might harm the child, and therefore they discourage or prevent such contact. If the children are with the other parent, that parent may be angry, or that grandparent may be angry at the parent who is incarcerated. And I think without understanding the impacts that that has on the child, they might think that they're doing right by the child, but actually further causing damage. So there is, and I believe this is in the material that Edie posted as well, a child protection best practices bulletin that's called Connecting Children with Incarcerated Parents. And it has a lot of really good information in it that tries to at least address some of the barriers to parent-child visitation. There is often inadequate information about visiting procedures, what is necessary, how you get approval for people to come visit, when can they come visit, how long can they visit. There can be geographic location of prison facilities can cause problems. The family may, maybe the family is as far away from Lusk or Rollins or Torrington as you can get. That can make it really hard to then travel to have visitation. If there are visiting procedures that are uncomfortable or humiliating, that can cause people to not want to load up and go there with the kids. If the visiting rooms are inhospitable to the children, that can be a problem as well. So we'll talk for a moment about the Adoption and Safe Families Act. It has caused a steep increase in the number of incarcerated parents who have had their parental rights terminated. Many prisoners do stints, even for minor infractions, that end up exceeding ASFA's time limits. And staying in contact with one's child can be crucial to preventing termination of parental rights. And then when you consider the barriers that we just talked about, you can see that that can be real serious challenges to parents being able to meet their case plan requirements and to children being able to reunify with their parents who are incarcerated. So I think probably everybody that's on this, that's listening in to the Blog Talk Radio, knows about the requirements of ASFA that states file a petition to terminate parental rights on behalf of any child who has been abandoned or who has been in foster care for 15 of the most recent 22 months. But I think it's also important to remember that there are exceptions to this, and that we need to look at whether or not the family that we're working for would be appropriate to qualify for one of the exceptions to the very strict time frames that are in ASFA, including when the child is being cared for by a relative, when there's a compelling reason for determining that termination of parental rights would not be in the child's best interest, or when the state has not provided the child's family with the necessary services. Because the typical sentence for an incarcerated parent is between 80 and 100 months, most imprisoned parents of children in foster care are going to be at some risk of losing their parental rights. We don't have great data, again, on how ASFA has actually affected the permanency outcomes for children in foster care, but there's some evidence that suggests that the number of termination of parental rights cases that involved incarcerated parents increased following the enactment of ASFA. So you've got state laws that really determine the grounds upon which parental rights can be terminated, including when the child has been left in the care of another person without provision for the child's support and without communication from the absent parent for a period of at least 1 year. That can definitely be triggered when a parent is incarcerated, as can the statute that talks about specifically when the parent is incarcerated for a felony and there's a showing that the parent is unfit to have the custody and control of the child. So with this, it is important to reiterate that incarceration itself is not grounds for termination of parental rights in any state, including Wyoming. So we did talk about the exceptions that allow caseworkers to examine individual cases for compelling reasons not to file a termination of parental rights cases. I think, again, it's just important to reiterate when we're working together with caseworkers as a very important stakeholder in child welfare that it's important to remember that that's not a bright line. The 15 months is not a bright line that absolutely requires in every case to move forward with termination of parental rights. I am on slide 36 for those of you that may be following along. If you're trying to avoid termination of parental rights, some of the things that you can look at and that the court may look at, the court may be less likely to terminate if the parent has been receiving frequent, consistent contact with the child. That's really important when the kids are in foster care. But those happen to be the children who are least likely to have visitation with an incarcerated parent. Parents rely a lot on caseworkers in order to fully participate in the dependency proceedings, including case planning, hearings, and court orders. So it's important that there is that communication between parents and caseworkers, and it's important that the correctional facility work to accommodate that. I know that that can be a real struggle with some facilities as well. If you're representing a parent who is incarcerated, it would be important that you address the legal responsibilities that incarcerated parents face and the barriers and opportunities that they will encounter in their efforts to gain access to their children and adjust their child support obligations to reflect their financial circumstances while they are in prison. There are a lot of resources for parents' attorneys on the Children's Justice Project website, and I really encourage you to take a look at those. As well, there are a lot of resources for parents themselves. And I gave you that link to that one guide for parents who are incarcerated. And I think it's really important that parents are given the resources to understand that the clock may be ticking immediately and that they need to make all efforts that they possibly can to work with their caseworkers, to work with their attorneys, to do what the court has ordered as much as possible from their end, to engage themselves in whatever kind of educational opportunities might be available in the correctional facility where they are housed as well. Counsel for parents need to be informed and able to competently represent parents on all kinds of issues, including child support, custody and visitation. You may be the attorney for a parent involved in a child welfare case or the attorney for a parent involved in the criminal legal system, but I think it's important if you're not going to help them, there might be a family law issue or a child support issue, that you at least help connect them with resources that may be available to help them out with those other issues that you may not have originally signed up for. There can be issues with how much public benefits they're entitled to, if they've used up all of their time on those, what the impact of being incarcerated has on that, on health care provisions for their children, if there's domestic violence issues. I think all of those are things that a competent attorney in any one of those areas should know how it impacts other areas that the parent may as well be involved with. Consider ways to cross-train and collaborate with child support enforcement, family law attorneys, TANF administrators, CPS workers and coordinators, domestic violence advocates, both that offer services for victims and treatment for batterers. I think that's really important to be a good attorney, that you know what resources are out there, and to coordinate with the caseworkers and with the other professionals that are involved in these cases at all different levels. Parents also have to know how to help themselves, because we can't do everything for them. And so while we don't want to do nothing for them, we can't do everything for them. And they're a really important stakeholder in the whole process. There are pro se packets that are available. I think it varies on the facility how much access to the internet an inmate may have, but I don't think they have any access at the Wyoming Women's Center. I could be wrong, and I hope I am wrong, but I don't think that I am. So they may have to get that information in hard copy, and that might be something that an attorney can do for them. Some other delivery issues of services that can be a problem and a challenge is that you probably are working, if you're working with a parent who's incarcerated, chances are that they have low literacy. They might have been disenfranchised, marginalized prior to their incarceration. They may be low income, not understand the importance of communicating with caseworkers, judges, and other professionals, and that can have, you know, long-lasting impacts on them. They may be unaccustomed to corresponding, like writing letters, making phone calls when they need to, filing forms, creating a paper trail. Conditions can be complicated by their inaccessibility and their moves to different facilities. And if they neglect to notify the court each time they move, they may not receive notices of hearings and or actions, including termination of parental rights paperwork. And I've had parents not know whether or not their rights are terminated, not know whether or not a guardian ad litem is their attorney, or they may think a child support enforcement attorney is their attorney. So just getting information to people in a way that they can understand it on an individual basis is really important. Also, judges, child protection professionals such as caseworkers, guardians ad litem, attorneys, have flexibility in the visitation orders that they draft during a parental incarceration. So you can draft them in ways that can encourage some reasonable visitation with the parent who is incarcerated, and not just cut off all contact between the children and the other parent simply because they're incarcerated in prison, and that thinking that that's automatically harmful. You got to look at it on a case-by-case basis. It's hoped that providing judges with information about the facility and the visitation arrangements that could be made there, their rules, their site dynamics, for example, can really help them understand that it could be an important, beneficial thing to facilitate that parent-child contact when it's appropriate in cases. I actually remember Judge Couts saying in a hearing that we had that he had gone to We were doing a hearing where we were trying to enforce a visitation schedule from a previous divorce case for a mom and modify it so that she could continue to have some level of visitation while she was incarcerated. And we had a lot of pushback from the other side, but the judge had actually been to the facility, had seen the facility, had seen where parents visit with their children, and he felt like it was appropriate in this case that the father accommodate reasonable visitation between the children and their mom while she was incarcerated. So that can be important just for judges to know that there are appropriate facilities, and if you've got the right case where visitation would be important, it's important, I think, to advocate for that. Let me see, because I want to leave some time for questions here. I gave you some ideas of information that you can disseminate to parents that you might be working with. You also need to look at what you can do to help them better reintegrate, get ready for discharge from prison and to reunite with their minor children. A lot of parents don't anticipate the difficulties that may be associated with doing so. And there can be immense challenges to building these productive lives for themselves, finding jobs, housing, health care, avoiding some of the issues that landed them in prison in the first place, paying off debts, including child support arrearages, criminal fines, court and legal fees and restitution. I mean, it can be very overwhelming for parents if there's not a good reentry plan that can be out there. And not only for parents, but it can be really stressful for their children, too. Children grow, they change, they often form relationships with new parental figures during their parents' incarceration. And that can make it really difficult for children to reestablish a relationship with a parent upon release. So some solutions that I'd like to just mention quickly. We can improve the data collection on incarcerated parents, maybe screen them when they're first going in to find out, do you have children? Where are the children? Do you have a child support order that's active right now? Do you need information on legal resources that may help you be able to modify that? Are you able to contact your caseworker if you have one? You know, all of the different barriers that we've talked about so far. To gather that information about children and foster kids, to try to work to increase keeping parents connected with their children, to know what resources are available for children who have a parent who's incarcerated, and to continue to promote collaboration and development of protocols between correctional facilities and child welfare offices. I think doing cross-trainings can be really important in this regard. Also, just to continue to work between courts, attorneys, and other providers so that we can provide a good level of service. There's another publication, I have it on slide 45, that talks about what your role is if you're a judge, a caseworker, correctional staff, a child's attorney or guardian ad litem, parent's attorney, law enforcement, CASA volunteer, foster parent, and what's the role of the children as well. And so those can be super good resources to help parents who are in there. Having policies and protocols and laws that talk about considering the exceptions to TPR, determination of parental rights, and looking at those with respect to permanency planning for children. Clarifying that parental incarceration by itself doesn't negate the requirements for reasonable efforts to reunify a child with his or her parent upon release of such a parent from prison, and that we need to stay focused on what's going to be best for the parent and for the child in the long run. Ensure that the parents have all of the information that they need so that they can participate meaningfully in dependency proceedings, and though these issues can be really complex and cross the jurisdictional boundaries of multiple agencies and service systems, it's important that we have thoughtful policy making in this area, that we get better data so that we know what we're working with, and that we continue to try to advocate and assist people to maintain these contacts that we think are going to be very important in the long run. We also need to involve state policymakers to take an active interest in helping children of incarcerated parents. So with that, I think I left 45 seconds for questions. Edie?
Thank you, Donna. Just a reminder, our next episode is January 12th, and that's about all the time we have. Apologies to Thane that we didn't get to his questions.
And I guess if there are questions, please feel free to email me at dplayton@uwyo.edu.
All right. Well, thank you, Donna.
Thanks, guys.